Welcome back, WNST, Tass in Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. The hat out front should tell you we're working on the new crab logo instead of the checkmark logo. All of our WNST partners have been incredible here through our transition from WNST.net to Baltimore Positive. And I'll tell you what, our friends at Darka Ice Cream are going to be doing a special offer through the holidays here with eggnog and peppermint bark and pumpkin spice latte, which is my favorite. We'll be doing that at Taharka and out at Baltimore Positive. Subscribe to us. We'll get you a deal there. Our friends at Fadley's are also shipping those world-famous crab cakes all over the world. It's one click away. Want to get somebody to love you during the holidays, on the right, on the left, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, inauguration, whatever you have, send some crab cakes from Fadley's. You will make them very, very happy. One click. Next day, somebody's going to be real pleased with you. Also, our friends at State Fair and El Guapo. I have my El Guapo shirt on. There's no truth to the rumor that that is Don Mohler there. Just a little resemblance between him and Brazzi, but not so much. I'll be stopping by there for a margarita and a delicious carnitas, as well as our friends across the street at State Fair. Evan Brown expanding across Frederick Road. And I know Mohler and Gary Realty also expanding far beyond Frederick Road. You can find them out on the website. And Jeff and I are going to get together and talk about whatever is going on with COVID and football and Marlon Humphrey and the Ravens and the Colts. Don, I remember when a Ravens-Colts week used to bring out the best and the worst of both of us, right? But we have a different kind of week here, a different kind of struggle than Mayflower Vans here in the aftermath of Tuesday. You booked a full docket of radio here. I don't know that we expected to have a result in the aftermath, but it certainly has been tumultuous here, and I know you brought some friends in here to try to set the record straight.
Well, I can't think of anybody better to come in and talk elections and analysis and try to give us the big picture and bring us in off the ledge than our good buddy and Baltimore Positive alum, but president for People for the American Way, former president of the NAACP, former Democratic candidate for governor in the state of Maryland, my good buddy Ben Jealous. Ben, welcome back to Baltimore Positive.
Thank you, Don. It's good to be here, brother. Nice to be with you, Nestor, too.
Well, after, well, yeah, I was going to say, yeah, we're both Nestor, like, go ahead, you know. Three, two, come on. You ran for office. What the hell are we witnessing here right now, Ben?
Yeah, depends on what level you want to talk about it on. We get like real granular. What we're witnessing is Joe Biden winning the presidency of the United States, and Donald Rumsfeld throwing his, you know, one of his last tantrums. I'm sure there'll be more before he's no longer president of the United States. Trump laid out a playbook. You know, he said that he was going to declare victory early. He was going to try to stop the voting of, you know, try to stop the counting of ballots that had been legally cast. And then he was going to go to the Supreme Court that he's packed with his buddies and see if he couldn't get them to do something highly illegal. He'll win. I mean, Joe Biden will win 270 electoral votes. It looks like he's about to win Nevada. There's also even a chance he could win Georgia. And that tells you a lot when Georgia's in play. I want to, you know, give a shout out to my friend of 30 years, Stacey Abrams, who's really, since we were a teen, really been focused on what she's doing there, which is really empowering the people of Georgia, all of them to have a voice in their politics, and it's paying big dividends. And we could win Pennsylvania too, but we're going to win Arizona. I mean, we've won Arizona, we're going to win Nevada. And what we're seeing Joe Biden accomplish right now, it was the most conservative path to the presidency. We're also seeing is that down in Georgia, it looks like Ossoff will be in a runoff. The trends, if the trends continue that we're seeing, we will have the opportunity to push the Republicans to a draw and be at 50-50 in the U.S. Senate with two January 5th decisions, to be made on who the next senators from Georgia will be. Georgia will become a massive battleground in this country for the future of the U.S. Senate. If you go back further, guys, and you just kind of get up on the balcony of history. My grandma is a 103.
Hey, Ben, we hear you better when you're closer up on the mic. I'm sorry, buddy. It's good.
That's good. My grandma is 103. She'll be 104 in 8 days. She's a retired Maryland social worker. She trained a much younger social worker named Barbara Mikulski back in the day.
And we've met her.
Yeah. Well, if you want to see Barbara cry, you mention Mamie Todd. You'll see what happens.
Don and I won 18 rounds with her. We lost.
Yeah, hell of course. That's every man ever.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, what my grandmother really lives on the balcony of history. She carries with her the century of American history she's witnessed and been a part of. And a century before that, a story she inherited from her grandparents and great-grandparents who were born slaves. And what my grandmother would tell you is, for 400 years, there's been an order of white supremacy, of male supremacy in our society. And that's all demographically, because of great social movements, coming to an end. 25 years, every group will be a minority. And Don's family reflects that. My family reflects that. Nestor, I'm sure yours reflects that in some way, like all of our families do, right? We're all living this kind of modern family now. And there's many of us who say, great, like finally everybody's going to have to figure out how to get along. That is a good thing for America. Now, there are other people who just want to hold on to the old order for whatever reason, maybe bring structure to their lives. They just don't want things to change. What my grandma would tell you is, if you were 25 years from the end of more than 400 years of white supremacy and male supremacy in American politics, you would expect the people who are most invested in the old order to lash out like a fox backed into a corner. And, you know, I live out here, Pasadena, Maryland. That's where I've been spending my COVID time. And there's lots of foxes. Foxes are meek and, you know, mild-mannered, mischievous little characters. And then you back them into a corner and wow. And what my grandma would tell you, you know, farm girl that she is, raised in Dinwiddie County, Virginia, long before she moved up to Baltimore City, is that the farmer doesn't tremor or tremble when the fox lashes out, because the farmer knows, is he sees reflected that the fox knows in the fox's viciousness, which is that the world's about to change on that fox in ways that will only benefit the farmer. And so that's where we have to be right now. We can't allow ourselves to be too shaken by the far right wing lashing out and doing what you would expect them to do if they knew that they're about to lose power. And the last thing I'll say is this, which one of the most amazing things in this campaign is the way that Donald Trump marketed himself aggressively at the Latino community and at Black men. You know, Donald Trump really kind of stands for three things: white supremacy, male supremacy, and national supremacy. And it turns out two out of three of those appeal to a whole lot of people. And some folks have dealt with white supremacy so much their whole lives, they're willing to, like, okay, whatever, you know. But these other two things feel good to me. That's why you see him. He has more support with men of any color than he does with the women from the same community, because the men are invested in that old order of patriarchy and, you know, more than the women are. But the other thing that he's done is he's approached politics like a marketer. And this is what we have to learn from. We should never again be able to say what we could say this year in August, which as of August, the last time I had a full report, the Republicans had outspent the Democrats 10-1 on Spanish language media advertising. 10-1. We're the party of immigrants. We're the party of working people. How is it even? And by the way, the chairman of the party is Latino. How is it possible that we're being outspent 10-1 on Univision and Spanish language?
Well, there's just a feeling that if you are of Latin descent, and I am, I'm Venezuelan, but I mean, I grew up in Archie Bunker's Dundalk, Ben, that right. The feeling would be, if you've witnessed this for 4 years, you don't see Donald Trump as the liberator. You would see him as Castro, not as Castro's savior. The thinking would be, if you had never met anybody in South Florida, never spent any time around people in South Florida, or come from a diverse family like I come from, or as I've said, half of my family came off the boat from Venezuela, and I mean off the boat, baseball, Aparicio, Orioles, 60s, in our lifetime came off the boat. Half of them are very far right wing, and half of them are very far left wing. There's very few centrists in the Aparicio side of my family. And same family, same background, same story, same uncle, same cousin, same experience. completely polar opposite. Not probably just unlike Mueller's family in Cadenceville, right? Who's like, you've had the same experience, but have a completely different take on where this is going and what Donald Trump and people like him represent.
No, I mean, you know, it's but, you know, again, going back to the marketing, what Donald Trump has done is he simply said, okay, I'm selling this product. It happens to be his presidency. Who's buying? And then he'll sell to anybody who's buying. And say that, you know, Democrats, we still take kind of an old machine boss, you know, and Don is an old machine boss, understands this. We should take an even older machine boss perspective, which is... Sorry, Don, I had to slip that in.
Hey, I'll take it.
You know. Hey, with pride, brother, with pride.
Like,
I ran for governor. I was told how I had to deal with Don Mueller.
Hey, I'm the only one around here allowed to give him a hard time.
Now tell him.
I'm built in.
Hey, was Don Mueller one of the elected officials that stood shoulder to shoulder, though, with your brother and fought the fight?
Oh, my God. You were incredible, man. That's why I love you. Hopefully your courage will rub off into Johnny Ocheffky. But anyways.
I love Johnny.
You know, I just wish he had more courage in that race, and you know what I'm talking about. But
He's doing great things.
He is. And we helped him a lot in this primary. He could have helped us in the general. Haven't said that yet. Only say it once. I'm saying it here. Now, what I'd say is...
I've said a lot of things since the election in a lot of ways. So get it off your chest, man. Get it out. It feels good.
You know, but what I'd say is this. You know, too many Democrats just ask, are we winning the Latinx community? Are we winning the Black community? Are we winning with women? That should never be the question again. That's what made this a nail biter. The question is, are we getting as many as we can get? Are we fighting for every vote? Republicans have had to do that because when you're pushing a white supremacist ideology in a country that's becoming increasingly diverse, well, you can't just bet on white people. And so they've got to go out there and try to sell this white supremacist to Black folks and brown folks. And you know what? They did better than we expected. And the Venezuelan community in South Florida understands this. You know, I mean, on what the Venezuelan community in South Florida wants is, you know, as far as all of these refugees and making sure that they can stay here and all of that, Trump's refused to give them. But you know what he has done? He sent his vice president down there like 24 times, and they feel like they have a relationship with him. And so the Republicans have been engaged, I'd say, in a sort of politics that the Democratic Party used to be famous for. We used to fight for the allegiance of every new immigrant to this country, every working person to this country.
Give us your poor, your tired. You can give that speech, right?
All of that, right? And Democrats, we've gotten a little bit of lazy, and you know, a little bit lazy. I think that we paid a price for it. So, leading an organization that, in many states, we were the only folks advertising for Biden on Spanish language radio. In many states, we were one of the few groups trying to advertise to young Black folks, like in the Upper Midwest. You know, pushed millions of dollars of advertising out the door. And all I can say is my prayer is that in 4 years that the Democratic Party has learned some of these lessons. This one didn't have to be as close as it was. I'm glad that Joe Biden won. I fought hard for him, but he would have been better served by folks who were ready to fight for the votes of every single American. And that's where we need to
go. You talk about failures, you know, with the Latin community. Let's talk about the Upper Midwest, because you just brought that up. That Michigan, Wisconsin, the plague came to Wisconsin. Obviously, voter suppression in a big way came to Wisconsin in the last 6 months. We all saw that. The whole world saw that. What happened there tactically? I mean, you're speaking of Biden in the he's going to win. And I'll get no argument. I mean, I'll make no argument on that. But if we're going to talk about how he won, right? I mean, we talk about the failures and how low everybody felt at 3 o'clock in the morning when this clown's up talking about he won the election and whatnot. We all had a little bit of that on Wednesday. But then there are the victories. There were victories here, Ben.
Yeah. No, there were, look, there were huge victories. I mean, first of all, you know, look, Joe Biden's victory, let's start there. You know, he quickly won every state that Hillary had won in 2016. He added to that a congressional district in Nebraska where they have fractional electoral votes. He added to that the state of Arizona. That was a big deal. And Georgia is still too close to call, so is North Carolina. That's incredible. And we very well may win Georgia. He also frankly took back, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin. That's incredible too. And we may be, you know, able to take Pennsylvania here. So that was a big deal. We got rid of McSally in the Senate. We got rid of Gardner in the Senate from Arizona and Colorado. That's a big deal. And we also won, you know, several transformative races at the state level all across this country. And here, you know, in Baltimore, I'd say it's a big deal that Brandon Scott is the new mayor. You know, Brandon, you know, may just be the most truly committed mayor that we've seen in a very long time in this city. I really can't imagine a politician in Baltimore. There are many who are as committed to the city as him, but I don't think there's anybody who's more committed to the city as Brandon. And, you know, I, for one, I have a lot of respect for Sheila Dixon. She's a complicated figure, but I know that the city will be better off under Brandon than it would have been under Sheila. I was clear about that in the race. You know, that's a big deal too.
Well, we've had Brandon on a number of times and confident that he will continue to join us. One of the things that I can remember, and Nestor said it was actually good news, Ben, and this is a little diversion, and then I want to jump back to Stacey Abrams. But you just mentioned two of the candidates for mayor in Baltimore City. Nestor, I think it's safe to say that you were pleasantly surprised with the caliber of people running who wanted to be mayor of Baltimore City, whether it was Brandon, whose personal story is just so compelling, whether it was Theroux, whether it was Mary Miller. We would interview.
Don't forget TJ, by the way, because I voted for him.
TJ Smith, who we grew very fond of. I mean, even when she, I love Ben's word about Sheila, complicated. When we were done interviewing Sheila and you were ready for Bear, you said, you know, if it weren't for that past and those indiscretions, she's pretty impressive. She knows how to make government work. So it was an impressive group of people. And that's one of the reasons why we continue to be positive about Baltimore. But Ben, one of my theories, and it's funny you mentioned Stacey Abrams. I know you guys have been buds for years. I said to my wife last night, and I want you to jump in and opine a little bit about this. I said, you know, when the history of this period in our lives is written, there will be a chapter on Stacey Abrams as a young woman who truly changed the electoral map and the direction of a state almost single-handedly. And my question to you is, do you agree with that assessment? And then for our listeners, I want you to tell them about the Stacey Abrams you know and what makes her this force of nature, Ben.
Stacey, to understand Stacey, first of all, yes, Stacey will be a historically important figure. She already is. She's the first woman to ever lead a party in the Georgia legislature. She became that at age 32. First Black to do so in the Georgia House, but the first woman in either house. And you know, Georgia, Black or white, has an old boys club that really controls politics. That's how they got this far without ever having a woman to lead. Stacey did it because she, you know, she was only, I think, in her first term, maybe her second, in the Georgia legislature, and she took on the Speaker of the Georgia House, who was considered to be the rules expert. You couldn't make a rules challenge and hope to beat the Speaker. He was the expert. She beat him. She bested him. Then she lined up enough Democrats that nobody else could win without the coalition that she had, and then she confronted the Old Boys Network that controlled the Democratic Party in the Georgia House, which is a Black Old Boys Network. And said, look, we're going to have the first Black minority leader of the Georgia House. And if that's going to be the case, it'll be me, because now the rest of you guys can win with the coalition I've already put together. So you're just going to have to fall in line. And, you know, Barbara Mikulski would recognize the sort of cojones that you got to have to do that to an old boys network. But that's who Stacey is. And she did it with grace. She did it without any venom or, you know, she just, you know, folks fell in line and she backed him up. And then they had an incredible run. She was able to shrink. Georgia's penal system was the fourth largest in the country. It's far from the fourth largest state. She and the Republican governor got together the activists in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party politicians in the Georgia legislature and did the same thing to the moderates who were frankly invested in the in mass incarceration. But they got the Tea Party affiliated legislators and the NAACP affiliated legislators to craft together a majority. And that's how they shrunk the prison system down there before California got around.
Say that again. That's an odd
I knew that. I knew that would.
Ben, I listen to the show. I do. So.
Yeah.
Want him to reiterate that coalition that she put together down there.
Yeah. So Georgia, this is about 10 years ago, had the fourth largest penal system in the country. It was maintained by moderate politicians in both parties who, quite frankly, were on the take from private prisons and the like, who were invested in keeping the prison system large.
And this helps the policing system be large, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Yes.
Yeah, yes. But really, I mean, there's a lot of money just around the prisons, right? There's all the companies that charge inmates a dollar or $2.
But it takes the police to put people in there, too. And lawyers are all of the machine. Yes, there's a whole machine there.
Yeah,
incarceration in our society is a machine. But people don't
profit off policing the way that they profit off prison.
Perfect,
because you're housing people and they got to call all that stuff. So she and I both, I was involved in helping. I was president of the NAACP. I got Newt Gingrich to endorse the NAACP report that we used to educate people in the Georgia legislature. And so what we did nationally, she was doing in Georgia with Governor Deal. Governor Deal was a Tea Party governor. Governor Deal's son was a drug court judge. Governor Deal came from the fiscal conservative wing of the Tea Party. The Tea Party also had religious conservatives who have a lot of people in the prisons doing prison ministry and understand that we don't just have the most incarcerated Black people on the planet. We also have the most incarcerated white people on the planet. And then in addition to the fiscal conservatives and the religious conservatives, you have libertarians who, if you say drug reform to a libertarian, you get them a drug. They are the pot smoking wing of the Republican Party. And so if you really look at people as individuals in the Georgia legislature, you were able to say these politicians are fiscal conservatives. These politicians are religious conservatives. These politicians are libertarians. And that's how Nathan Deal looked at his Republicans. And he got those activist Republicans together. Stacey, it was a little easier. The NAACP has such a presence in the Georgia legislature that on the Democratic side, that there were very few Democrats, maybe 10, 20%, who weren't willing to follow the NAACP state leader when he said, we can do this a better way, let alone he was backed up by national. But they got the activists, Democrats and the activist Republicans, to form a majority that isolated the moderates in both parties who were invested in, you know, getting contributions from private prisons and the like. And that's how Georgia shrank its prison system. Stacey's an incredible coalition builder. She's an incredible leader. And, you know, I saw this when we were, when I met Stacey, and for folks who are, I guess you watch this on video, not just listen to it. So this is, you can see this. This is me and Stacey when we were 20 years old. Stacey's right on the front with a big smile and her hair pulled back. I'm the guy in the background who looks like a cross between Ice-T and Chuck D in that Pittsburgh hat.
And so, I was going to say, what's with the Pirates hat? What's going on there? That's all I saw was the Pirates hat, and I thought, we lost to the Steelers the other day. I'm not in the mood for that.
I was a Chuck D fan. It was a public enemy thing back in the day. Nobody even cared about the Pirates.
Did you rap, Ben? Is there any audio of you rapping back in the day?
I was a very good slam poet for a bit, but you know, kept it acoustic, if you will. So, but the Stacey back then, I mean, Stacey was incredible then. Stacey was a sophomore in that picture. She was on her way to becoming the first student body president at Spelman to not be a member of a sorority since the sororities have been on campus. Wow. Sororities have been on campus for about 100 years now. that was a big deal because the sororities were their own political machines. You know, this is all women's college and they ran the votes. And she built a coalition across them and she won. She would get death threats her junior year because as the first one not associated with the sorority, she felt like she had a moral obligation to recognize the lesbian and bisexual group on campus. The sororities wouldn't do it. They didn't want to be associated with it. Stacy did it. She literally had a fire outside, set outside of her dorm room by somebody who was so outraged. They lit all the posters on her dorm room. She had all the different posters as a student body president. They lit them all on fire. That's how angry they were. She had tremendous courage. But she was also just a very skilled operator. Don, you'll appreciate this. So Stacy gets a job as an intern in the mayor's office of youth affairs her freshman year of college. The woman running it is a woman named Melanie Campbell. And Melanie is now a civil rights leader. She runs a group called the National Coalition for Black Civic Participation. She's run that for about 20 years. But back then, she was running the mayor's office of youth affairs in Atlanta, and Stacy was an intern. And back then, we had things on floppy disks, and Melanie had lost the floppy disk with the final copy of this big proposal. So she brought it to young Stacy. Stacy was a great writer in part because her father is severely dyslexic, brilliant preacher, brilliant pastor, but severely dyslexic. And she would help him with his graduate student papers. He would dictate them. We didn't have dictation software then. So she would dictate it to his daughter. She became a great editor at a young age. And Melanie knew that. And she said, look, I'm going to need you to retype this proposal. And by the way, there's no, you know, if you got any ideas or improve it, like, go ahead. So Stacy, fast typist, brings her, she's, by the way, written and published 9 novels, or 10 at this point. Started 4 startups. I mean, this woman's a brilliant leader across a whole culture, business, and politics. Stacy says to Melanie, you know, a day later, look, I've retyped it. And also you said I could think about improving it. Well, again, you know, take it or leave it, but I gave you, here's one that I think might be better. And Melanie liked Stacy's version better, so she submitted it. And in that was a half-time salary for Stacy to have a permanent job in the mayor's office of youth affairs, a full-time secretary in her own office. So as a sophomore in college, even before she was student body president, down at City Hall, she had a full-time secretary in her own office and a guaranteed job. So Stacy is just like above average in every way. And yet, what is appealing to her, and what folks, whether it's West Baltimore, where my family's from, or it's Dundalk, Nestor, where you grow up, what they would recognize her is her grit and her commitment to working people. Her father was a hero of the civil rights movement in southern Mississippi. The Hattiesburg boycott is one of the most effective boycotts of the civil rights movement. Her father was the enforcer at 17. Before he went to seminary, he was a dock worker organizing other dock workers in Biloxi and also had a street ministry. And her mom was the school librarian. Her parents... when they were both seminarians, they're both now very established Methodist pastors. When they were both seminarians, raising their 6 kids while going to grad school, were so outraged by the mistreatment of the homeless at Christmas time in Atlanta that they dressed up as Mary and Joseph, led their 6 kids and an army of homeless people to occupy Coca-Cola headquarters. So there's a certain depth of capability, but also resolve to Stacey Abrams that I guarantee you, we will see her run for president one day, and she will be a very serious force.
Well, Ben, let's continue with the Stacy narrative for a moment, because again, this could change, but as we are recording this, it now appears as if both Georgia Senate races will go to runoffs. With the as we're recording, I keep looking at my phone. The latest results from Georgia show that Purdue, Sonny Perdue in Georgia is now below 50%, which means that John Ossoff.
And for the past several hours going into this, he was dropping at a tenth of a point every 90 minutes.
Right. So that's consistent, continuing to happen. Here's my question for you. Immediately, and it is so funny in the world of punditry, and you and I have talked before about how it can make you crazy at times and how people take assumptions from the past, they try to apply them to the present, and you say, not necessarily. So immediately, I already see popping up on my feeds that even though the two Georgia Senate races are going to go to runoffs on January the 5th, That means that Republicans are about to win those two Senate seats because Republicans always outperform Democrats in runoff elections historically. And my gut says that may have been true pre-Stacey Abrams, but I'm not so sure that playbook still applies when we know control of the Senate is on the line. What are your am I off base, Ben? Am I crazy?
No, you're exactly right. I mean, let's be clear. Raphael Warnock was chair of the New Georgia Project that Stacey Abrams, you know, founded. I was one of the founding advisors to that group. These are very serious leaders. Raphael is far from just a pastor, and Stacey is far from just a retired politician. They are true movement leaders who understand every lesson of how you build power from the outside. That's the title of Stacey's book, by the way, Leading from the Outside, in a place like Georgia. And they have done the hard work. I mean, yesterday in Georgia, there were threats of militia violence. And so Stacey Abrams made sure, and we talked early yesterday morning, that she had volunteers at every single polling place in the 150-something counties of the state of Georgia. Some of those counties have 10,000 adults. Every single polling place. There was an old Democratic Party that was capable of that. We have not seen that in the modern era with Democrats in the Deep South, that they're able to literally make sure that every single polling place has volunteers. But Stacey has built that apparatus. And then what Stacey does, right, like, you know, right now it's census, whatever, is that she'll get contracts for those same workers so that you're not just engaging people election from election, but you're keeping them working on the census or you're keeping them working on issues related to healthcare in the off time. She has built a modern political machine in Georgia that should be the envy of every state party because she has, you know, thought like an organizer. And we were, that's that photo of us. We were at an organizing training put together by the A. Philip Randolph Institute for young Black student leaders in the history and effective techniques of Black trade union organizing. You know, Stacey is a leader in a way that kind of fuses together, if you will, the best of Fannie Lou Hamer, Bayard Rustin, Ella Baker, Diane Nash. Like literally, you think of the greatest organizers coming out of the Black civil rights tradition. She has learned from all of them one way or the other, and yet has updated that playbook for the 21st century and for Democratic politics.
Ben, my mother grew up in Abbeville, South Carolina, near Augusta, near Spartanburg, Greenville, near Clemson, quite frankly, off 85. Mm-hmm. And I think about what the South represents, and I've referenced this, maybe we reference it with you. My wife and I saw To Kill a Mockingbird last year, sort of weirdly in a hotel room, and put it on and got spellbound for 3 hours. Probably the only movie I've watched the last 5 years, quite frankly. And I'd seen it, and the South for Atlanta and for what it represents in Biloxi and other places, and I've been all throughout the South. College football does that to you. But for me to think about 10 years, 15 years, 20 years from now, real change, you know, Civil War's 150 years, real change that would affect Alabama or Mississippi or South Carolina. I mean, a lot of us thought Harrison had a chance, right? I mean, certainly of all the people my wife wanted to see lose, it was him, right, in South Carolina. Well, maybe, I don't know, but you get what I'm saying, that Atlanta's always been the Athens of the South and in the middle of everything, and that if Atlanta changes, maybe there's a real chance over, you know, the lifetime of my son, the next couple of decades, that would change things outside of the perimeter there.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, the Georgia has been changing rapidly for years, and the Deep South is a place where, frankly, Black folks have bigger families than most of the rest of the country. And Black folks are also returning to in their retirement. You know, folks like that my mom grew up with in West Baltimore, who, like her, were born in Petersburg, Virginia, you know, but then moved up when they were babies to West Baltimore, but spent every summer back in Petersburg with their grandparents.
I was on a Greyhound bus to Abbeville, South Carolina every summer for 20 years, Ben.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and it's, well, it's, you know, what we say in the black community is true about Southerners, white and black, right? Which is, you know, Northern white folks have many summer camps. We only have one. It's called Grandma's House, right? Right? Like, you know, what summer camp did you go to, Nestor's? Grandma's House, Utah? Grandma's House, where did I go? Grandma's House. Three different locations, but the same summer camp.
You know? Well, my mother called it home to the day she died. She was 98 years old. Going home this summer, home.
There you go.
That's what she called it.
Well, that's where our folks were from for hundreds of years, right? I mean, when you dig into it in many cases. So what I'd say is this, that the South has never been allowed to be the South. Slavery was an abomination. Segregation was an evil creation. It beget a great migration that pushed black folks unnaturally out of the South. And what you're seeing now is folks are creating opportunity. They're moving back and creating even more opportunity. And we're finally going to see the South be the South. And you see it already in congregations, even in more conservative congregations, they are more racially integrated in the South than you would expect or you would have seen 30, 40 years ago, which totally makes sense because, you know, if you understand like the origins of evangelical preaching, it actually has a multiracial origin. You go back to the history of the Pentecostal church starting with Southern emigres to Los Angeles who were led by women and by black folks and by white men all together. And so the South is kind of settling into being the South. And that's really what Stacey represents. And, you know, the South is a place of intimacy, where we all know each other, right? Like both, you know, like, I mean, look at my, I'm not this color because like my dad is white. Yeah, he's white. But if my mom like looked like somebody from, you know, Kenya, I'd look more like Barack Obama. But my grandmother, black grandmother, descends from Thomas Jefferson's grandmother by her other grandchildren that were her slaves.
You know, and, Ben, that, go ahead. I'm
sorry. Yeah, no.
Boy, did you just peak a memory for me. I remember, God, this probably goes back to my college days. It might even have been a discussion with Perrin Mitchell, who was an adjunct professor at Western Maryland College at the time. And I think it was Perrin, and he had this discussion, and he said, just what you just said. He said, Don, you know, it's a weird thing. He said, in terms of how we're going to make progress and neighbors really being able to talk to neighbors about race and being familiar with one another, he said, what I'm going to tell you is totally counterintuitive. It's going to be easier in the South than it is in places like Boston and other places up north. Because in the South, we know each other. Yes, they kept us down. Yes,
play football. Lynching, play football.
We,
play ball
we
together.
We knew we were neighbors. We knew who was up at the general store. And when you just said that, it was like, wow, it just piqued that memory of me of that discussion with Perrin that day.
Well, and that's part of why we had to get Donald Trump out of office, because he was baptizing young folks into a style of racial hatred that we really need to be rid of. And there is a certain sort of undeniable sort of slow roll momentum of the South of the walls between the black side of the family and the white side of the family going down. Like when you're in a place like they say poverty is the best form of historic preservation. It's a lot of poverty in the South. Things don't change much. So with that said, what it means is that what your name is in the South means something. If you're a Bland, you're from Petersburg. And you can go right through the South like
wow.
That, different names. You know, if you're a Sharpton, you're from South Carolina. Is it a mistake that Al Sharpton's first name is Alfred and that Strom Thurmond's maternal uncle is also named Alfred Sharpton? Not at all. They descend from the same Alfred Sharpton.
Wow.
Think wow. About that.
Keep right? Going. Preach. Preach.
But,
keep
but
going.
I mean, like, if there were two sides of one coin, it's kind of Strom Thurmond and Al Sharpton, right? I mean, if you think about it. And then, right? Both polemical partisan leaders, right? And then
But you would say 50 years ago, you'd say, well, they have the same God, right? So they can meet there, right? That you know, they go to the same, right? I mean, literally.
Same
right?
Everything, you know, and then you go down to Mississippi, Merle Evers will tell you that she's cousins to John McCain. She comes off the McCain plantation. And she knows who her great-great-granddaddy was. And, you know, kin to John's great-great-granddaddy. And all those great-great-granddaddies are hanging out back on the plantation. And they all had kids black and white. And you know what? Like, for my daughter's generation, like, they don't care. For me, it's a little harder. For my mom, it's a lot harder. For my grandmother, it's even harder still. I met a white bland once. Our family gets the short stick of adjectives. Jealous, bland, it's just not a good said adjectives, but my, you know, my grandma's family, the Blands, I'm sitting, Dawn, at a conference that the Clintons had pulled together, and there's a woman sitting across from me named Maggie Bland. And long story short, we figure out that we both come from, like, the same plantation in the old Bland Magisterial District in Dinwiddie County, Virginia. And she just gives me a hug and says, I always knew I had black family. And then she goes on to explain that Mammy, she knew Mammy was blood because Mammy, not her Mammy, like you might say, like my nanny, but Mammy, like mommy, could get the sisters, that was her mom and her mom's sisters, on the phone and squash any argument just with a word. And only blood could do that. And so, there's an intimacy to the South that has been interrupted by the walls of segregation and slavery and the traditions of hatred, that's eroding. And the interest in DNA and, you know, the just the kind of natural inclination of human beings to bond to each other over things more important than color, like character and religion and aspiration. And the fact that the South is a pretty sedentary place where a lot of folks don't go in or out of most places, think is leading us to a place where the South will ultimately lead this country in reconciliation. And again, that's why getting Donald Trump out of office was so important, because he was this kind of northern interloper who was what they call a strategic racist, just like George Wallace before. You know, George Wallace in 1948 ran for governor of Alabama, endorsed by the NAACP. He supported the integration of the military. He was an FDR guy. He was a war on poverty. You know, he was a anti-poverty guy. He was really focused on sort of the common struggles, the black poor and the white poor in the South. And he got beat by a candidate whose slogan was essentially the N-word. And George Wallace turned to his staff and he said, I will never be out N-worded again.
Yep.
And he turned 180 degrees. And then after he got shot, you know, when he was leading the Maryland primary for governor in 1972, when he got shot.
Laurel, Maryland.
He turned 180 degrees again a few years later, and he repented. And the reason why it was people were able to accept his apology is they could say, you know what? We knew what you were doing all along because we saw you running 48 and lose. And then we saw you running 52 and win. And you turned 180 degrees, and we knew you. We endorsed you back in 48. We knew where you came from. We knew who you were. And so, yeah, it's believable to us that this was all a very dangerous charade for a very long time. Well, Trump is a little bit more, you know, a little bit different. He's been pretty consistent in his racism outside of public life. Heck, his father is the only slumlord that Woody Guthrie ever wrote a song about, Old Man Trump. So there's some, you know, it may just be the real thing, but he exploited it in politics in the way that George Wallace did. It was very crass, and we've got to get beyond that so the children of our country aren't rebaptized in the racial hatred that we would all like to evolve beyond.
Wow. Nestor, I tell you what, this was such big picture and so philosophical. I don't even want to gum it up by talking what governance is going to look like. I want to take this and meditate on this a while. And Ben, just say, boy, the insights were powerful. You give us hope. And Nestor, do you have anything else for our?
No, I want to go back to a conversation we had earlier just about we're lacking civility, right? You know, that's what we've seen the last couple of years. I think there's a line between lacking civility and criminality that has been crossed at 3 o'clock in the morning when you declare victory and basically say the whole thing's a fraud. What do you see to be the pathway on the other side, the OANNs and the Trumplandias, and what will happen now that you believe Biden is going to win, is going to govern, is going to be inaugurated? What happens to Trump and Trumpism? What goes on the other side?
Trump will monetize it like he does everything else. You will see Trump TV or something like that. He'll seek to be, you know, the Uber Limbaugh, the Uber Glenn Beck.
But can I get a Trump steak again? That's really what I need to know, you know?
No, and he'll seek to create a political dynasty, you know, try to see if he can't get Don Jr. or Eric, or, you know, maybe it's his daughter to run. You know, that's where this is headed for him. And the part that makes me, you know, really sad about that is, and you see what he's doing with the election, is that he literally attacks Americans' faith in their government. And that's why Russia supports him. I mean, let's be clear. You know, Putin's interest wasn't in helping Donald Trump win. Putin's interest was in degrading the American people's faith in their own democracy.
Right.
And Donald Trump is such a narcissist that he's just happy to have somebody cheering for him, even if that person is really cheering for the demise of our country. And that's where it kind of sticks in my craw, because, you know, I grew up in the Cold War. Like, you know, we all got a little bit of PTSD if you grew up then. You know, I would like to be a more cosmopolitan guy, I guess. But I take great offense at the President of the United States, you know, ultimately helping the interests of Russian intelligence. Like, OMG, WTH, when did this become acceptable? And so
I think Norway. I think Norway is when it became acceptable. As I remember it.
No, it's insanity. Hey, guys, if you want a little bit of delicious irony, because those of us who follow this stuff love this, and Ben, I don't know if you've been checking your phone, evidently right now, as we record this, just as our guest Ben Jealous predicted at the beginning, evidently a number of outlets and networks are now getting close and prepared to call Nevada for Vice President Biden. Evidently, they are tied in knots at Fox News, because they now are faced with the fact that they either have to take Arizona off the board or declare Biden.
Put 270 up, right? Right.
Elect. So they evidently at Fox News, there is total chaos at this moment as to whether or not they pull Arizona back or follow along, because it looks like folks are ready, as our guest said, they were just about ready to call Nevada for the vice president.
Well, you know, Donald Trump said the other day that Fox News is biased against them.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that for a second. He said Fox News is biased. I was trying to explain this to my 8-year-old son this morning. He was cracking up. I mean,
he was screaming, Ben. He was screaming at Fox and Friends, which has been his own personal communication effort for the past. He was screaming at Fox and Friends that they weren't helping him enough. I mean, can't make it up. Hopefully, by the time this gets published, we'll have a vice president-elect.
Ben, I just want to say this at the end of this, because Mueller set up some guests this week, and he didn't even want to do these things in the aftermath of all the mess, and then things have turned or whatever. You've helped us here. You've provided incredible therapy here that his sister from Jacksonville will be providing next week in the aftermath.
You did.
Thanks, Ben. We appreciate you, brother. Hey, tell everybody how to get in touch and help you. How can we help you?
Yeah, sure. Look, if you want to become active in People for the American Way, which is a great civil rights organization founded by Congresswoman Barbara Jordan and Norman Lear in 1981, you can reach us at pfaw.org. Two things make us different. One, we are, from the beginning, the most intersectional of the major civil rights groups. We really take a ethic of all for one and one for all. And the other is that we have the courage to get involved in campaigns, actually endorse the good gals and take out the bad guys, and we just helped take out Donald Trump. This is a very good day.
How's Norman Lear doing, man? 98 years young. I just looked him up, man.
Hey,
I
mean, you know, Norman just
I already dropped an Archie Bunker reference in the middle of this thing, man.
Oh, I mean, that's, you know, hey, we're the house that Archie, Edith, and the Jeffersons built. What I'd say is this. Norman just broke his own record. In 96, he was the oldest American to ever receive an Emmy. And in 98, he set the record again. He has a Good Times cartoon that he's co-producing with Steph Curry that comes out. He's literally working every day as a TV producer. He's never slowed down. And he talks a lot these days about his experience as a combat war vet. You know, he flew 52 bombing raids over Europe during World War II. Deeply upset with Donald Trump's comments about vets. Just deeply like hurt and upset in a way that I think only a combat vet can be.
You know, I know we have to wrap up, but every time Ben says something, it makes it again. Ben, that point that you just made, and you're such a national voice out there, please help make this happen. I'm convinced that one of the things that Democrats get beat up on all the time, and they should never get beat up, is they've allowed Republicans to paint them as the party that doesn't love our country, the party that doesn't appreciate military service. You're very fond of your history of military service and your family. Nothing could be further from the truth, but boy, does that narrative take hold. So I hope you can be part of a group that turns that around.
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of, let me just say this thing, all right? There are four languages for sort of singing to the heart of the American people. The language of love, the language of faith, the language of patriotism, and the language of aspiration, the hope that you can create a better future for your children. We as progressives, we as liberals, we as Democrats, whatever you want to call us, people from the center to the left, have become uncomfortable with speaking any language to each other except for the language of love. And it is a failing strategy for winning the hearts of the American people, but the worst thing is it doesn't represent our own hearts. We are all motivated by patriotism. We are motivated by faith. We are motivated by aspiration. Yes, we're also motivated by love. And our great leaders from FDR to Shirley Chisholm spoke all four languages. One of the things that we just, I just said under my leadership, we have 1,300 young Democratic officials, for instance, organized, is we will train every single one of our leaders to speak all four languages.
Boy, perfect ending. What a
Ben,
way to wrap
up. We appreciate you, man. We'll send everybody out. We appreciate the time. We know we've gone long with you. Thanks, as always. And stay Baltimore positive out there. We'll get through this thing, man.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate you guys.
Washing his hands, wearing his mask, Ben Jealous, and, of course, former Baltimore County Executive Don Mueller joining us here on Baltimore Positive. We have merged the streams, expanded the conversations, appreciating the sponsors and loving them up, and still doing the Ravens better than anyone. We are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore Positive.